Hello, and welcome to the Love Mia Vita podcast. I'm Jerry DiPiano, CEO of FemPharma. Thank you for joining me as we discuss all things women's health and wellness. Please note that this information is simply that. It's information to help you to think through your decisions. Please consult your medical practitioner to discuss your personal situation. Thank you. So today, my guest on the Love Mia Vita podcast and part of the WIN series, Women Inspiring Nonconformity, is Danica Kelly, who is the CEO and founder of Mind Normative. Welcome, Danica. It's so nice to see you, and thank you so much for agreeing to be my guest on Love Mia Vita podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It feels like this has been a long time coming.
Yes, it really has. But your company is really inspiring all of us to think more about the ways in which women's health, and specifically women's health through the transition, really needs to be investigated in a more rigorous way. So I am so excited to learn more about Mind Normative. And I'm also happy to say that many of the listeners will be excited and energized by this conversation, because what you're doing is truly groundbreaking and needed, so needed. So first of all, let's hear about you, Danica.
Sure. So my background was in medical anthropology before kind of starting this journey. And I think that gave me a unique lens on looking at health and wellness, both from a culture-bound concept, but also from a systems and systematic perspective, thinking about what are the ways that we assume things are normal that may not be, and things that we may assume are scientifically rigorous and valid and may not be, because maybe irk some scientists on the call, but even science is culture bound, right? The limits to how we think about the questions that we ask and the way by which we ask them is dictated by the cultural and social fabric that we are a part of. And so I observed kind of in my own studies and in my own work that there seemed to be this deficit in asking the question of whether or not the way by which we are capturing that data was precluding some of the outputs and outcomes and health inequities that we were seeing in kind of real life around sex and gender differences in the healthcare system.
And we know that, because I've been doing research for many years, starting with Big Pharma for the multinational companies, and then over 25 years at FemPharma, where we did still do prescription pharmaceuticals as well as consumer products, that to a large extent, women were left out of the equation. Now, in 1993, women were required to be included in clinical trials, but we weren't looking necessarily at the incidence and prevalence and marrying that with, or companioning that with, the population, the study population. And I use a variety of different examples. So people say, oh, well, you know, it's reproductive health. No, it's actually the A to Z of women's health issues. And we could start with Alzheimer's. Thank you, Dr. Lisa Moscone, for pointing that out. And Dr. Moscone is a neuroscientist, a neurobiologist. And she points out that our brains are different and estrogen does matter. So we need to take that into consideration when we study women at various stages and ages. And I think that is what's missing, right?
I totally agree. I think there's three things you've hit on there that maybe are great segues into further conversation. One is that the change was simply for inclusion. It wasn't actually for any sort of differentiated assessment of the female body, which is an incredible, it's a barrier we still today see today, right? People will go, oh, well, we have 30% of our study is women identifying, and therefore we are hitting our threshold. But as the old adage is, you know, you can't assess a fish, or you can't judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree. And so as long as we are still measuring females as males and assessing them as males, their inclusion may or may not be actually having the impact that we are looking for it to have, right? That's a really, really challenging thing. The second thing that you've hit on there, I'm going to forget one of them, that's okay. But the other one that I really caught on to is kind of that transition through life stages. So most of the innovations that we have, oh, I remember what it was, focus on specific parts of the female life cycle. So we look at menopause, or we look at eumenorrhea, or we look at menarche, or we look at pregnancy and postpartum. But up until this point, we haven't actually assessed the female body through time and allowed the female body to age, right? We look at the impacts of pregnancy on the body, but we don't look at how the impacts of pregnancy impact menopause, how they impact Alzheimer's. We don't tie those things together through time. And that is a huge deficit in the scientific world. And the third part, I think, which you've hit on really well, is because we have traditionally focused on women's health in those reproductive life stages, we don't see the knock-ons of how that impacts Alzheimer's or cardiovascular disease. And we're just starting to move beyond what people, I think, have colloquially dubbed those bikini sciences into understanding that these changes the female body goes through time that are unique have knock-on effects in every area of health and every major system in the body.
Absolutely. And I love something that you just said, bikini science. So at one of the first investor meetings where I presented, I think I got the attention of the disproportionate male audience by saying women are more than a set of breasts, a uterus, ovaries, and a vagina. And there were men that slid under their chairs pretty much or gasped with their mouth dropped. But it's true, and it's unfortunate because women have always been viewed as the default male, and it starts with medical school education. So there is an initiative underway by the Medical Students Student Association to incorporate many of these types of things into their medical school education so they are much more tuned in to sex-based differences, because we have to keep in mind that sex and gender are different, right? So we want to keep that in mind, but we do want to embrace sex-based differences and discover ways in which to more uniquely study those sex-based differences. As we think about drug development or providing services or developing medical devices, et cetera. So we do need to look through the transition, the life transition. I think that's what my normative has really done in terms of changing the game, so to speak. So tell us more about My Normative. How did you found the company? What are you doing? What types of companies or individuals or practitioners can benefit from the way in which you have developed this business?
Thank you so much for the segue. I think there's a few things. So My Normative is a health research platform, and the objective of the platform is making it easier to identify, assess, and address the ways by which sex and gender may be impacting our research, right? So we work a lot with public-facing research organizations, whether that's academic institutions or public health organizations, but also now more and more into that private sector for people who are doing research and innovation. And so the objective, when we look at, so this is a Canadian quote, but I feel like you will still appreciate it. So we've had, since a similar amount of time at the Canadian Institute for Health Research, CIHR, it's our equivalent of like the NIH, from a health perspective, we have had policies that require the inclusion of female bodies. And we have now some stuff around the requirement for accounting for those differences, but not any tools or ways to actually do that. And so the number one and number two accepted reasons still within the ethics board are, one, males are a perfectly adequate proxy for females. So that's one reason for justifying the exclusion of females from a clinical
Odd.
study. And number two, that female hormones are just outrageously complicated and you couldn't hope to include them. And so what's mind-boggling to me is that those two things seem mutually exclusive and yet are the most, like, they're it's number one and number two. And so you're like, how are these both still the amount of cognitive dissonance that you have to see both of those as equally viable and equally true is mind-bending. And
It is.
so we were like, okay, if it's too complicated, let's remove that barrier. And so the platform is meant to make it so that there's decreased participant burden, decreased cost, the ability to increase sample sizes, because the other big critique we see in women's health research is that those sample sizes are too small because of the level of financial and participant burden that gets placed on participants to be able to create best practices, policy recommendations, and protocols out of them. So we wanted to decrease cost, decrease logistical burden, decrease financial burden, and really make it so that if you get even a couple of dollars to do a study in women's health or include female bodies in your trial, you're able to really quickly come to a point of understanding on where sex and gender as variables may be guiding differences in your experience and what you're seeing in the data.
And that makes so much sense because we have often heard these arguments as well. So in going back in time, yes, there was something called paternal benevolence. We all know it existed. And the paternal benevolence was, well, we don't want to expose women in their reproductive years to an antidepressant because perhaps it's going to impact their unborn children. Unfortunately, women in their 20s and 30s who are bearing children or conceiving are still taking those drugs. By the way, many of those drugs were studied before the requirement to include women in clinical trials was mandatory. So just think about it, ladies, anybody listening to this podcast, if you're taking an older antidepressant, oh, by the way, newsflash, there hasn't been a whole lot of progress made in that field of antidepressants, to pick one, in 2 decades. So guess what? 1993 wasn't that long ago. You are proudly taking an antidepressant that was really never studied in a female population in a woman's body. So this makes it easy, right? I think what you've done here at MyNormative is you've taken away all of the objections. Number one, we can do all the tracking. Number two, we can reduce the cost. Number three, we can easily recruit study participants. This is not mind-boggling any longer, or you can't find an excuse
Yeah,
to
that's
exclude.
really the goal, right? And so obviously most of our adoption to this point is people who already have drunk the Kool-Aid, right? They're like, I know that women's health is important. I know the female bodies are unique or different, and I want to account for that. The big, I think, like saturation point that we're all chomping at the bit for is what happens when we are not just looking at female specific use cases and when we're looking at things that may just impact female bodies differently or disproportionately. And that's I think culturally, when that tip over happens, we're going to have a whack of eureka moments within the life sciences community in terms of understanding where antidepressants may need to be tailored to the female population or where heart disease medications need to be tailored to that female population.
You talk about how pregnancy-related complications may impact women later in life during the transition. And it is so true. We just did a podcast recently on cardiometabolic health. And one of the examples that we raise is women who have preeclampsia are at risk for more cardiovascular issues than women who haven't had those types of issues during their pregnancy. And by the way, it makes sense. If you've had hemorrhaging, if you've had preeclampsia, if you've had gestational diabetes, all these increase your risk factors as you move into the transition. But have we studied that? We know the answer. Sadly, the answer is we haven't adequately studied it. So let's talk about some examples of where MyNormative could play a role. Could be if you are a drug developer like Phem Pharma or one of the Phem Pharma companies. Where do you tailor this? So we work in conditions like endometriosis and overactive bladder, et cetera. We work on the consumer side too, as you know. But using that as an example, how would we use MyNormative?
That's a really good question. And I think that's often the crux of it. I think for so many people, the system is so entrenched on the way to do it now that the idea of accounting for these variables is it can be quite overwhelming. And so maybe I'll take a two-pronged approach to this. So the first one is just like the practicalities, and then maybe the extra conversation is the advantages of doing it that way, because those are kind of two different arguments for there's like the moral impetus of you should do this, and here's the
Yes.
practicalities of doing it, and then here's all of the cool advantages that come out of that. So you would stand up MyNormative like you would any other observational or interventional study. So we have a companion app that is the participant interface. So if you have data collection points or appointment notifications or anything else that you want to do, basically what happens is the researcher goes in, they set up, here's my project, here's how long I want to surveil people for, here's the amount of people I want to collect, here are the geographies from which I will be collecting them, here are the questions I want to ask them at the frequency at which I want them collected, here are the biomarkers or the biometrics I want to collect in addition to that. All that gets packaged up nicely, shipped into the MyNormative app. Somebody goes into MyNormative, finds the study, signs up, goes through informed consent, And once they've gone through informed consent, the app, I will call it magically because I'm not the technical founder, magically transitions itself into being the app that is specifically designed to capture those data points for that research study. And then from that, it's just a normal research experience. The interesting underpinnings is that if you are a female participant, we have tied it to whatever your reproductive life stage is. And so there may be questions that only populate prior to ovulatory events. There may be questions that only populate prior to a bleed or during a bleed or in each clinically relevant hormonal stage that you go through. And what this does, it just allows us to understand how the data you capture is differentiated across the hormonal states and the reproductive life cycle of the female body, so that if there are differences in how the body reacts to the COVID vaccine in perimenopause and menopause, that gets flagged fast. And you can start to understand where there may be additional pardon me, market opportunities for your products or where there might be some risks that you need to manage within different populations, right? So there's, I would definitely acknowledge there's a little bit of a double-edged sword there from a product development standpoint, but citing McKinsey, like there's a $1.6 trillion women's health opportunity here. And so finding out more about the differences across sex and gender is only going to, I think, argue probably open up your market in terms of understanding where the gaps are in female health versus close it, right? So that's the basics of it. And so implementations for us have been in academic contests, so observational studies on how a specific disease or illness interfaces with those that hormonal variability. Also in terms of interventional, so seeing if we're running this and we're doing this intervention, does that efficacy or efficiency change across those hormonal life stages? All those sorts of pieces, it just gets built in so that you, as the researcher, the data just gets organized into those states and it allows the differences to emerge faster versus you going through and being, oh, I collected that August 3rd. Was August 3rd in a high estrogen state and a high progesterone? Where was August 3rd? And so instead of you being responsible for all of this intellectual legwork, it's just put into your data set that way so that it's easier for you to understand.
You know, we look at things like mood disorders as a prime example for where this makes so much sense, because we know that in the DSM-5 revised, there is a mood disorder, which is PMDD, okay? And it's associated with your menstrual cycle. So for those that are not very accustomed to looking at these types of resources, this is the Bible, as it were, for illnesses, for mood disorders, et cetera. And so there's a description of what PMDD is, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. It's another way of saying you have a bit of a mood disorder, but it is tied to your cycle, right? Now, where is it worse? So if you are administering an antidepressant, perhaps you want to titrate the dose or change the dosage regimen when you know that things are becoming worse. That would allow you, as a drug developer, to make different types of products or to recommend different dosages or dosage regimens or target the therapy very specifically to a region where you know that this is impacting the overall absorption of the product, right? So lots of different ways to think about this, where it comes down to drugs that are uniquely suited to women. That's not to say that you wouldn't have products available for men. By the way, anytime we learn more about women, it benefits men as well. Not just because you may have a partner who is a woman or a mother or a sister, which is all, of course, great, but because you learn more about male bodies when you understand more so about the female body. So it's all good stuff.
And I think the other piece to that is, to your point, when we were talking about earlier, is it's not just understanding, you know, PMDD or antidepressants. One of the things that I hear often anecdotally from women again, understudied, there's some emerging study on it, but that when you go through a reproductive life stage transition, drugs that you've been on for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years stop being effective to the same capacity. And so thinking about whether it's antidepressants or anything else, if you were on that and then you go through perimenopause, your relationship with dopamine is changing, you're like everything is moving around. And so something, you start to feel a little bit stir crazy because something that worked for you for 30 years might not be working anymore. And that is an incredible market opportunity in terms of continuing to understand and develop out that space. I really want to like dig into the idea of it being a risk to understand female health and female bodies better. It's not. It is an incredible opportunity to diversify portfolios, bring new innovations to market, and better serve the female population.
Give you another example that actually is very relevant. It's autoimmune diseases. So if you think about a
Absolutely.
disease like rheumatoid arthritis, so you think of RA, or you think of lupus, or any one of a number of autoimmune diseases, the course of the disease changes over time with your transition from your re the height of your reproductive age through perimenopause. Menopause is one day, so postmenopause, but everything's lumped into menopause. And that's because some of the other things that impact you, like hyaluronic acid. So hyaluronic acid, which is naturally occurring in your body, and in particularly in your joints, starts to decline as a function of the decline of estrogen, almost mirrors that. So imagine now you are perimenopausal and surprise, whatever you've been prescribed doesn't seem to be working quite as well because you have that exacerbation caused by this decline in hyaluronic acid, which is actually supporting and providing some support to those joints, right? So, lubricating the joints, now all of a sudden that's declining. So perhaps you're feeling more pain or stiffness. So that's another example. And we see that that does shift and change during the perimenopause, menopause transition. But would you ever think about that? Oh, by the way, autoimmune diseases disproportionately affect women. So no surprise there.
No surprise there. And I think the other piece that I think is it's the citation that people provide all the time, right? So I think people say like, oh, women control 80% of consumer spending in a household, and that's kind of the piece. And I think if you can, and if we look even at vaccine hesitancy within the population right now, that's really driven from women feeling unheard, under misunderstood, dismissed in their health concerns, for better or for worse. If you can tap into and collect and validate your clinical trial or your real world evidence with the inclusion of and the consideration of women and their physiological realities, the market pull and the social capital that you will get from actually going through that process is an incredible opportunity, because I really believe that if you can address some of these fundamental concerns that so many women have with the medical system today, that is nothing but a market advantage.
Absolutely. We talk about companies that can benefit by the use of MyNormative, but it really covers the spectrum. So, we put the woman, in this case, the woman, call her the patient, but it's the woman who's at the top of the pyramid. And then you have the practitioner, the healthcare practitioner. Let's chat a little bit about how the healthcare practitioner benefits by having this tool available.
That's a really good question. So we are just starting to transition into university-based studies versus like pure research plays, and in terms of into hospital-based studies. So one of the things that we're finding, so the unintended use that came out of one of the earliest case studies of MyNormative was that participants in the studies, who were often also patients, then had these incredible data sets that they rigorously collected over time and were able to then take to their practitioners and say, you know, I get maybe why you weren't listening before when I said, yeah, I just have this weird recurring pain and like whatever. If you can then go in with that data and say, look, this symptom populates here are all the kind of like factors around it. That is a lot more for a practitioner to work with to understand, oh, you aren't sleeping right before ovulation on a regular basis. What might that be correlated to? What systems can we put in place to help you address that? Or something potentially a little bit more nefarious, right? So it's really helpful to have that data capture from a patient advocacy perspective. And then as we work more into the clinician and the practitioner side, it starts to become a informing tool for the guiding best practices, guiding protocols, developing out identification mechanisms for intervening faster and shortening that diagnosis cycle in the female body, because we all know how outrageously long that is. And so that becomes a really meaningful, like that's where we're, in terms of an ultimate health outcome, that's where my normative is starting to push to is, yes, let's facilitate the R&D, let's get as far upstream as we can. And then with all of the insight and exposure and intelligence, start to change the rate of diagnosis and the rate of intervention in female bodies so that we can actually start having better health outcomes quicker in the system.
It definitely makes sense. It's interesting. I just wrote an op-ed piece for a publication, and the one of the questions that was asked was, how would you advise women who were unsure about what's going on during perimenopause and menopause? And in a very primitive way, I always say the following. If you're a healthcare practitioner, you might be seeing 35 patients a day, and that doesn't give you a lot of time to spend an hour with that patient. It would be great if that were the case, but it's just not a fact. It's not happening. And no disrespect at all to any healthcare practitioners. They are overburdened and have been way before the pandemic. So I would say bring a diary. Keep a diary. Keep a diary through the month, every month. You will write it down. You will see patterns emerging. But imagine if you had the data in your hands, if you didn't have to have that paper diary, but where you could collect this. So is there a day of the month? What happened during your menstrual cycle? Did you not have a menstrual cycle? What drugs did you take? Did you take a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug? Are you on birth control? You're not on birth control. So all of that data is super helpful when you walk into the healthcare practitioner's office, and she doesn't have to spend the first half hour because you've got this information in hand. So I see this as so beneficial to doing exactly what you stated, expediting the diagnosis, giving your healthcare practitioner the clues that might be missing, and most importantly, self-advocacy. Because let's face it, when you're suffering from whatever, whether it's mood swings, or vaginal dryness, or pain in your joints, you're looking for a solution. And no healthcare practitioner wants to send you off saying, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do for you. Yet often that is what happens until you've been there for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months or more. And then finally the patterns emerge. So all good for the healthcare practitioner. And then most importantly, it's for the woman. I think we spent some time chatting about for the woman. What does this mean to women and women's healthcare?
I think that's really, so the reason why the company is called My Normative is because there's so much normalization that's not true or accurate about how you should experience perimenopause, or how you should experience pregnancy, or how you should experience postpartum, or how you should experience your menstrual cycle. And so we know, and I don't know the stats for all the reproductive life stages, but from a eumenorrhea perspective, like fewer than 15% of the population that's menstruating has a perfect period, like a clinically like described menstrual cycle. And so with that being the case, that means that 85% of the population is not normal. And so we wanted to go, okay, let's give you the tools to understand what your normative is, so that as you are engaging in a clinical trial or a real world evidence study or whatever it might be, out of that, you have this increased knowledge mobilization, knowledge translation on how your body behaves over time. And from that, you have the agency and the empowerment to then go to your practitioners or to go to your care providers and say, this is the data I've collected. This is my reality. This is how I'm interacting with this, whatever that might be, whether it's an intervention or a sleep quality issue or a joint mobility or a joint pain issue. This is how I'm interacting with this. I need help. And it allows you to understand and advocate for yourself at an incredible increased rate versus, well, welcome to your 40s, welcome to perimenopause. Like, that's just not helpful rhetoric. And so My Normative is named as such to help overcome some of that.
And it's interesting, different women experience menopause differently. And we haven't even talked about the racial disparities in some of this, because racial disparities are a reality. And I'm going to use three letters that people may not want to hear, but they're going to hear them. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. DEI, say it again and again and again. We believe in that, because if we lack diversity, the populations that suffer are women and they are persons of color, and they are persons that define themselves differently. And we must take those populations into consideration because we know that the disparities exist. And yes, some of it is socioeconomic, but much of it is because our bodies are different. We need to be thinking individualized therapy. We need to think about the impact that our hormones have on our bodies, but we also need to think about the impact that some of the different that our cultural differences may exert and physiological differences may exert on our ability to actually benefit from treatment or to have different treatment or to have earlier treatment. So we'll use DEI as, as much as we possibly can because that's so important when we think about clinical medicine, when we think about anything, but especially with the topic that we're discussing today.
I would argue that I agree that medicine is innately intersectional, right? No mechanism operates by itself in a silo. And so if to pretend anything else is outrageous and kind of in the face of the Western medical tradition, period, point blank. And so to draw artificial lines that say, well, the intersections stop here, seems really, really silly. And so whether that becomes a genetic diversity play or a sociocultural, socioeconomic diversity play, I think it is intellectually honest of us to say that those things are going to intersect, that they are going to impact our data, that they are going to impact our real-world health outcomes. And so the better we can account for that in the earlier stages of an interventional development process, the better and the more robust our results will be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We 100% agree with you. And those that do research should recognize this and do recognize this. And I guess that brings me to the research in women's health. And I know we've both read the McKinsey data. There was one that just came out in January of 2025. I don't know if that was before or after January 20th, but there was more information that came out, which encourages support for women's health research and largely incorporates what we have known for a long time in a very substantial report. How do we impact longevity? Longevity is a big topic these days. Women might be living longer, but they are the disability associated longevity is pretty profound. So, yes, you can live longer, but what is your quality of life? And if your quality of life is poor, and it is for women, then that hardly speaks to making progress in women's health research. So, I know we're kind of at a pivotal time with women's health research. So, any prognostications from you as to what we can do or how we can do it better?
Ooh, an invitation to prognosticate.
Yes.
I
Use your crystal ball. I mean, we do need to encourage more research. What are some compelling ways that those of us that are listening could be that you're a lay woman, could be that you're a researcher or an investor. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think the first thing, and you and I actually touched on this right before we hit record, which is don't be afraid of the market. Unfortunately, women's health has always been fraught. It has almost always been politicized, and it has always been challenging. And so the innovators and the entrepreneurs and the researchers who are dedicated to this space are not afraid of this. They are used to this. They are going to continue to push through this. And so do not, I think, step off the gas. I think is like keep your foot on the pedal, because regardless of what any one government's administration is doing, I would say women's health is some of the most hardened innovators in the world because it's always been awful. And so whether you are an innovator directly or you are a just an advocate for or passionate person engaged in this space, I think the it's not so much a prognostic, doesn't matter, words left me, a crystal ball moment, but I think it's words of encouragement of like, we have momentum, we've been through hard things before, and I don't think anyone is particularly afraid of continuing to push through what's going on. So whether you're an investor role, keep investing. If you up your investments, because the people who weather this are incredible, and you're going to make an incredible return on that investment. If you are an innovator and you're able to find the funding, scrap together the pieces, reach out to My Normative and reach out to me. I'm happy to point you in any sort of directions I can to help you make whatever budget you might have go further, farther, faster. And if you are a lay person or a non-academic, non-business person, get involved in your community, get involved in studies. I think that the more data we have, the faster we can start to make really meaningful, tangible arguments around implementation and the acceptance of new modes of thinking.
That's brilliant. I love it. And you must have seen my pillow. So I'm just going to pull this up from behind me. It says, "And yet she persisted." It's been the theme for us for decades here because we keep marching, right? That's the, if anybody saw SUPS, that keep marching is a theme, but it is a theme for all of us that believe in continuing to fight for you, the woman, because you deserve it, because it's important, because if we encourage women's health research, it benefits all of us. It benefits the economy. It benefits men and women and children. It benefits all of us that care deeply about issues like brain health, physical health, mental health, societal health. So there are many reasons. And again, we look at the demographics, and the demographics should speak for themselves. If you think about the world's population, we are still the dominant force, even though we are not treated as the dominant force. So encouraging women's health and women's health research, not giving up, persevering, that will change the dynamic. Keep marching.
Keep marching.
Well, Danica, thank you so much for being our guest on the Love Mia Vita podcast. Love Mia Vita podcast, as you know, is sponsored by Fempharma. And we are just so delighted to see another woman entrepreneur who is a woman inspiring nonconformity to join us. Thank you once again. Be well. We love what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Love Mia Vita podcast. Love Mia Vita means love my life, and that is a mantra we should all live by. Please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and check out our website at fempharma.com. Remember to live well and love Mia Vita.